Okay, I believe it's time to start. So you are in the session about overcoming bitterness with the sweetness of the gospel. So let's bow our heads and have prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you for this time. But Father, I want this time to be yours. So Father, whatever is worthy, then I pray that that will be what's remembered. So, Father, your word is active, living. And so we want you to use it in our hearts, even during this brief time. So I pray this in your son's name. Amen. So we're going to begin with a case study, and this case study is in some ways similar to the one that Carol, for those of you who are in the session before, told us about. So a middle-aged woman came to see me, and she was sent because she had been in a prolonged grief. Her husband had gone to be with the Lord about 4 years earlier. And her children were concerned. Her friends were concerned. Grief was still intense. She was suffering some from depression. And she had begun to just withdraw from church activities that once she had been thoroughly involved in and had enjoyed. She had two children, five grandchildren, and I'll call her Mary. And, of course, there are some details of this that have been changed. I'll call her Mary. Her daughter had four children, and the daughter and son both lived locally where she could spend time with them. Her son was divorced and had one teenage son, and he was currently dating a former classmate of his. She lived in a very affluent neighborhood, and they had lived there for quite some time and had actually raised her two children in that neighborhood. She'd recently begun a part-time job. It was one of those job share situations as an administrative assistant. And there were some job-related challenges. Here, she'd not been employed outside the home for over 20 years. And so the new job limited the time that she had with her family. But in some ways, she was relieved because her daughter was expressing great frustration over her prolonged and intense grief. When we talked about her husband, she had such a glowing and positive reflection. Everything she reported almost seemed unbelievable. She talked about their wonderful marriage, his great provision, his fatherhood, best father, their friends, involvement in the church. And then she contrasted that with her very unstable home. And her parents, she'd never known her father. Her mother was an alcoholic. And her mother frequently was expressing disappointment over this daughter. She didn't look like she wanted her to look. She didn't act like she wanted her to act. And in fact, there were people in her extended family who seemed to bully her. So she comes to me, and the presenting problem is this extended grief about over a period of 4 years. So I began with counseling the grief. And some of the things we did, and this is, I'm going to go through a lot of this very quickly, some of the things we did, but not the extent of the counseling. Her church had a grief share program, and so I recommended that she go to grief share. She started grief share, but decided then that she just wasn't quite ready for it. I said, okay. And I had actually gone with her a couple of times to her church to this program, hoping that that would encourage her to stay. But she was not ready. We worked through some psalms, some lamenting, and considering the "but God" in those. An example, Psalm 10, 16 and 7, "The Lord is King forever and ever. The nations perish from His hand. O Lord, You hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline Your ear." But she was not faithful to do her homework. And that's hard because of the compassion that you feel for someone there. So, you know, we would work through some of her homework during our sessions to see if maybe she just didn't understand the assignment or understand the depth of thinking that I wanted her to do in her homework, or how the response that she should have. We tried connecting her with another widow, a widow who had more recently had her husband pass away, but that didn't quite work out. We looked for opportunities for her to be involved in her church, and we had, which she had just really been pushing away from church and not attending very much, but we said, you know, let's start doing that. And so I had given her a spiritual gift survey that was authored here at Briarwood. I gave that to her, and we went through that and looked at possible opportunities at her church for her to participate in. And so she got started, but didn't continue. Then we looked at identity issues, because she had spoken so highly of her husband. I thought, okay, she found her identity in him. And so let's now consider, where is your identity really? So we worked on identity. And she was still saying, I am in a perpetual state of sorrow and grief. Then I learned a little bit more about her children and just her life. One of her children had begun to approach her with some difficult things, wanting her to give money or maybe sign over the house to children's names now, and wanting to be kind of a financial assistant or advisor. So we worked through struggles with that. We worked through some disappointments. She found out that her husband, even though they had lived in this affluent neighborhood, that her husband had really not made some wise financial decisions. And so it had left her needing to go back to work. So when she went back to work, it was out of need. So, and then I learned more and more about her living situation, and I thought, okay, we're going to look at this kind of depressive state she's in, and we worked on daily structure, what should a schedule look like, your time with the Lord, your time on the weekends with church. We worked on diet, exercise, sleep, and medicine. You can tell that this counseling situation was going on for a very long period of time. Okay. And then we worked on, or we thought about, I started seeing these conflicts at work. And they were often kind of picky. She wasn't actually there with the other person. It was a job share, but she felt like the other person had made her sick because they had not properly wiped down the desk area and the keyboard and everything. And so there was conflict there. Finally, so this had gone on for quite some time. Finally, I went to an ACBC conference and went to a session about bitterness. And the Lord directed me to, when I saw her the next time, to ask her to read Ruth 1, 19 through 21. So we're going to read that to you, Ruth 1, 19 through 21. This is Ruth and Naomi. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So I asked her in a session to read that. And after she read it, I asked her, "Do you relate to this? Would you want someone to call you bitter?" And she said this was her. So I'll come back to the case in a little bit. But that is a start to what we're going to take a look at right now. My new prayer for her was that she would come to love the Lord more than her desires for what she had had, and that her desires would turn to be the Word, prayer, fellowship. And that she would start doing her homework. So we'll come back to her, and I called her Mary. So, recognizing bitterness. Here's a definition. I wrote it on your sheet, but I left some words out there, and you can see them on the screen. So bitterness is defined as a perpetual, intense hostility and resentment that leads to harsh treatment and unloving opinions of others. When you think about that, unloving opinions, then you can, you know, think back to 1 Corinthians 13:5, where we're not to take into account a wrong suffered, but when someone is bitter, that's exactly what they do. They take into account every wrong suffered. Okay? Bitter people are caught in a state of spiritual toxicity, and their poisonous attitudes and actions cause great damage. When we think about the Hebrews 12:15, that we'll look at in a little bit as well, but it says that the bitterness produces defiling. It's defiling fruit, and it affects the person as well as everyone around them. then acrid bitterness inevitably seeps into the lives of people who harbor grudges and suppress anger. And bitterness is always a poison. And Elise Fitzpatrick, well-known biblical counselor, calls bitterness a leprosy that consumes the soul and eats away at grace, forgiveness, and mercy. It's interesting because, see, just think, it's so different from Carol, who early on recognized kind of a problem to work on. Here, you know, we spent so many sessions working through different things, just trying to find out more and to think, what could this be? Jay Adams has said that often bitterness it can be underlying, and that it's can be hidden, but that, and both Dr. Adams and Elise Fitzpatrick say that if you don't deal with the bitterness issue of bitterness early on, that then you make little progress. Well, that is exactly what happened. Little progress. So, bitterness can take different forms, and here's some common forms. J. Adams also says it's very common in the counseling world. And he often equates bitterness with the term resentment. But, you know, common forms, bitterness results from adverse circumstances. That's what we saw in this case study. In that case study, bitterness can be in response to another's sin against us. And Dr. Adams gives an example of a young woman who was a missionary child. Missionary kid, and in that missions organization, the children could not live with the parents while they were serving as missionaries, and so the parents had put her into a boarding school about 350 miles away, so they saw her seldomly. Well, years went by, and they were devoted to God's work. But she was neglected, felt abandoned. When it got to be time for her to graduate from high school, she did, but she suddenly decided that she began to understand that this growing resentment in her and bitterness was just so much, but she didn't want to come out against her parents, and so she just went silent. And so she was evaluated by a psychiatrist who determined that she had lost touch with reality. And they were trying to work with her in that. But she ended up seeing someone in Philadelphia where Dr. Adams was. And they came to realize that what she was experiencing was this hidden bitterness, and that she actually was quite in touch with reality. And then they worked through reconciliation with her and with her parents. And happy ending to the story. Okay, the parents recognized their sin and repented of the abandonment of their child. And she received and recognized her sin in her response to that, and reconciliation occurred. So that was a happy ending, though, to a sad story. And if we think about that early diagnosis of she's lost touch with reality, when actually it was a choice that she had made to just not speak. Another thing is bitter response to an offense. And Carol mentioned this. Sometimes people become so sensitive that almost everything is offense and offense to them. Or imagined offense, as in her thinking her coworker had not wiped down the area when she came in, and it was her fault that she got sick. We see bitter responses to offenses, particularly in marriages. Dr. Adams calls it a reservoir of resentment that can build up. We see it in when we hear so much about shootings now, mass shootings. You know, the bitterness that welled up within someone that then they it came out, it comes out in that way. And so, you know, I often, when I'm talking with a counselee, we try to talk about what really happened. Sometimes offenses are just something perceived. You know, you kind of think. you misread someone's actions and think they did something on purpose. So here's some evidences. This came directly from Lou Priello's book, about a little booklet about bitterness. But here's some things that can be, not always, but telltale signs of possible bitterness. So I'm not going to talk about all of them, but I thought I would talk about some. Like acts of vengeance. Typically when we think of vengeance, we might think of some physical action, but it could be backbiting or gossiping, spiteful remarks to someone. Withdrawal, the silent treatment, the cold shoulder, you know, just hoping you get their attention so that then you can spout out everything that's wrong, or hopefully they'll recognize they have hurt you. Or outburst of anger, emotional overreactions. And Carol talked a little bit about that. And that's when hurts may have built up. Sarcasm, snide remarks, mocking, cynicism, I'll believe it when I see it. That kind of thing. Abuse, and you know, verbal or physical, or even I've had one person tell me that her husband, when he looks at me, he looks at me like he hates me. Intolerance, lacking forbearance with someone else's idiosyncrasies, that's something in marriage. Making a mountain out of a molehill. Disrespect, a contempt for authority. Rebellion. And the comment was made that rebellion hardly ever occurs apart from bitterness. It begins with a seed of hurt, sprouts into bitterness, matures into insubordination, and then develops in contumacy, a stubborn refusal to comply. Then this confabulating an offense. That goes along with that elaboration somebody pointed out earlier, how often when you've thought about a wound, a hurt, so much, it suddenly has grown larger. You've added a bit of imagination and motive and everything to it. And you can elaborate on details. Details. And it sounds like Carol's case study She elaborated on details. Arrogance, kind of a critical, condemning attitude, judgmental, and thinking, oh, I would never do that kind of thing. So some of those are evidences. We can see them in other things as well, but Dr. Adams makes a point. He says, one who harbors resentments within but acts as if nothing is wrong lies and does not speak truth to his neighbor. So that, you know, goes along with don't let things build up. Go and get the truth about a situation. So one of my favorite verses, it just almost applies to every counseling situation, is Proverbs 4:23, where it says, guard your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the springs of life. So a couple of comments here. Resentment, this is from Dr. Adams, one of the most common problems. It can be one strong link in a chain of complicating problems. When an original problem goes unresolved for a time, resentment often grows as a complicating factor. It in turn leads to further difficulties. And envy, resentment, and revenge, mixed with self-pity, constitute the bitter ingredients of many counseling situations. So, you know, we as counselors need to arm ourselves with basic facts, really, about who is God, and God saying that He is the one who will take care of these matters because He cares. He's a just God. So, here's a diagram, and I often use it with counselees. This is just part of it, and we'll develop it as we go along. But, you know, here in the left, circumstances, sin, and offense, or an offense can happen. And the arrows represent this fact that they go back and forth within our mind. We elaborate on them. In Carol's case, she elaborated for 30-something years. But that can happen. And when I'm doing this with a counselee, I just make that cloud darker and darker and darker. Because that's what happens. It grows darker in our mind. And we talk about how do you deal with those thoughts, and part of it are what are we thinking about and how can we transform our thinking. But in that elaboration, it's like bitter rain falls and roots of bitterness spring up. Elise Fitzpatrick says, these roots grow more pervasive as it's allowed to flourish. And then the arrow to the side produces defiling fruit. And I mentioned that earlier. It not just defiles the person, but it defiles everyone around them, either as a result of outbursts of anger or acts of vengeance, or gossip and slander. Okay, let's go back to the first page, and I left out some things I wanted to say about some biblical exhortations, just as we think, you know, about guarding our heart with all diligence. So here's that progression. Let all bitterness, okay, and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you along with all malice. And Dr. Ulrich teaches that that is a progression. But often what I've seen is that someone may be Christian enough to hold back the wrath. Wrath is probably there in the inside, but the outburst of anger and the loud clamor and the slander, you know. But then it seeps in, it stays, and it ends with malice. That is intent to harm. And, you know, all of it forgetting that God cares. Then Hebrews 12:15, I mentioned Mark 11:25, and whenever you stand praying, forgive. And that's the verse that follows the Ephesians 4:31. Ephesians 4:32 tells us to forgive. If you have anything against anyone, so that your Father also who is in heaven may forgive you your trespasses. Oh. Now, when we think about the Lord's Prayer, Matthew 6. Okay, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And then, of course, my favorite verse. When I think about that verse, I also think about a book that I'm just going to throw out there. It's a little bit sad, but I want you to know about it because it's a classic. It's called Hinds Feet on High Places by Hannah Herned, and it talks about what's in our heart and how it grows and it becomes difficult to remove. But it's an allegory, and it goes so well with that verse. So we're going to take a look at a biblical narrative. And this is something that you're very, very familiar with. But when we think about this, and this is Amnon and Absalom. Okay. Now, when we think about this, we typically think, okay, about the sin against Tamar. We think about, and that's Amnon's sin. He disgraced Tamar. Absalom had righteous anger that he then responded in a bad way. That's what we typically think about, okay, when we think about that passage. But we're going to think about it in a little bit different way. And that is that. And we're going to think about it. I think I made a list on your handout. Yeah. Beliefs, desires, thoughts, words, and behavior. And that's a kind of a paradigm of thinking from Byers. And I've listed all the references at the end. So, Amnon, Tamar's brother, has righteous anger against his brother Absalom. And he goes to his father, the king, the authority, about it. But the authority, the father, doesn't respond in the right way. Doesn't respond, really. So then, what is Absalom thinking? The sin against Tamar must be avenged. She was disgraced. She's desolate. My father, her father, the king, did nothing. Okay? Now, He steps into unrighteous anger. Amnon must be punished for his sin against her, and I must do it because no one else will. So his desire is that Amnon must die for his sin. Now, apparently, he's forgotten what he probably learned as a child in Deuteronomy 32:35, where God says, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." So he does not trust the Lord in this. Then his thoughts, 2 years pass. And he says, "For 2 years I've waited for the king to employ justice. Since he will not, I will." So he plots to kill Amnon at a sheep shearing event. And his words are, "Strike Amnon, then kill him." And that's what happened. So his behavior, well, he fled. He was actually away for 3 years. Now, you think about those 3 years. Okay, he's feeling justified in what he did because God, the king didn't do it. The authority didn't do it. God didn't do it. I had to do it. And now look where I am. I have to flee because result. I wasn't the one who did this wrong thing. Okay. So all of this probably, you know, it's festering. So finally, David's friend, Joab, convinces him, and King David brings Absalom back to Jerusalem. But David refuses to see him. So he has to stay apart in another house. And can you imagine the bitterness now that grows? My father sent for me to come back to the kingdom. Amnon was the problem, not me. I just did what needed to be done. Why are you, Father, treating me this way? Well, Absalom settled in, had a family. He named his daughter Tamar after his sister. Time passes, in fact, 2 more years. So now think about all the time. 2 more years pass, and he's thinking probably that 2 years have passed without my father acknowledging Amnon's sin against Tamar. My father acts as though nothing happened. So his desire, well, I must see my father. I'll do whatever it takes. So he gets what he deserves. His thoughts, "I despise this king, my father. What kind of king or father is he? I'll take away his power and his kingdom. I'll get revenge for his lack of justice." And that's important, that lack of justice. So, taking a look at 2 Samuel 15, if you want to after this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were judge in the land. Then every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. So you see the connection between the king and the lack of justice for what had been done, and all this that had seethed for years and years. Okay, it goes on. So, verse 10, Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king at Hebron." And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. And a messenger came to David, saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom." Then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom." So just thinking about that, the seething and the complete rebellion and maliciousness that follows. Now, I hate to say it, biblical narrative, but that can happen in real life. It does happen in real life too. And so that would be one of those examples where there's actually sin. Now, yes, sin on top of someone else's sin, it's complicated, but it's real. And God gave us a picture. This is something that at ACBC conference one year, John Street gave this little ditty of sorts. And I thought, so interesting. When bitterness towards circumstances is acute, then bitterness toward God is the root, and bitterness toward others is the fruit. And I've had people say something similar to, "God has made a terrible mistake in this." And what they're really saying is, "I know what's best, not this." And, you know, rather than God's sovereign hand behind a hardship, they don't realize that He is working to accomplish His good purposes. So bitterness results when I desire the comforts of life, the way things were, maybe, more than my desire for an intimate relationship with God. I want to wallow in self-pity because of God's frowning providence. I love the state of victimization because then it's somebody else's fault and I have no responsibility. I'm not responsible to God. You know, we as counselors know, and we need to help our counselees come to understand that the difficulties of life reveal what you really believe, expose our real thoughts about God. And difficulties are the chief tools that God uses to reveal our hearts. Proverbs 17:3, the crucible is for silver and the furnace is for gold, and the Lord tests hearts. There we have Romans 8:28, but notice I have verse 29 with it. In all of these, in all of these things, it is because whom he foreknew, he predestined to be conformed to the image of his son. And that's our goal in the counseling process. Other verses that I often share with counselees, Job 42:1-6. Okay, there, nothing can thwart God's good plan. Genesis 50:20, with Joseph. They meant it for evil. God meant it for good. And then Psalm 37. Don't fret. In fact, yes. I think I can repeat it. Difficulties are the chief tools that God uses to reveal your heart. Okay, I love Psalm 37. We often with counselees, I've worked through this. Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in his way. Psalm 37. Okay. Doubt and mistrust of God's providence and sovereign goodness is the core sinfulness of bitterness.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Mm-hmm. Doubt and mistrust of God's providence and sovereign goodness is the core sinfulness of bitterness. So, conquering business, bitterness. Confess, 1 John 1:9. Repent, Mark 11:25. Forgive, Ephesians 4:32. You know, when we think about forgiveness, what is it really? And there's so much more to talk about forgiveness, but we won't be talking about that necessarily this time, except that it's necessary in order to get past bitterness. I will not dwell on this. I will not bring this up again and use it against you. I will not talk to others about this. I will not let this stand between us or hinder our personal relationship. And that comes from peacemaking, from Ken Sandy. But the key to that, Ephesians 4:32, and this is what really speaks to the counselee when we get here, is as God in Christ forgave you. That speaks to the heart. They have a hard time walking away from that. And then transform thinking. And so there are some of my go-tos on that. And the Colossians 3, 1 through 17, the put off, put on, which we're going to go back to the case study and talk through that briefly. So, transforming sinful bitterness, and this is using that same paradigm for transforming and looking at a put off and put on from Colossians 3. So, my counselee's core beliefs: God says He loves me, but He doesn't really. And she looked at that from the time she was a little girl and experiences she had from childhood on up to then being blessed significantly, but then losing her husband and losing her security financially. Her other belief, God cannot be trusted. And it's so interesting because before I had considered this through this paradigm, one of my assignments, we were beginning to work through Romans 8 already. And so then as I looked through this, verses in Romans 8 apply to everything here in transforming her thinking. So I put for this Romans 8:39 is what she should put on. And Romans 8:28 and 29. Y'all can look these up later. I think we might run out of time. Okay, her desires. I need to have the life I used to have when I was happy. My kids were happy. I was financially unconcerned. Okay. Romans 8:18. Her other desire, I need other people, like my children, to look after me. I need a family like other people. This is another desire. Romans 8:34. Okay, her thoughts. I have the right to be depressed because my circumstances are terrible. So Romans 8:12-14. And her other thought, I don't feel like doing anything, especially if it's spiritually mindful. Remember that lack of homework or the beginning something and not continuing in the Word. But she's changing. And she's receiving because she's beginning to understand what she was thinking about God and harboring in her heart. Let's see. So Romans 8:11. Then her words. No one loves me. The only person who did was my husband. And my children loved him more. And then her words. I'm in a state of perpetual sadness, despair. Romans 8:35. Then her behavior. Well, I had come to learn that her house was a disaster. One of the things I had recommended as we were working through different things was, why don't you get somebody to come to your house and help you organize? She was embarrassed even to have anybody come because they couldn't even get in the front door. So her behavior, she allowed her house to become overwhelmingly disorganized, and she would not clean or straighten anything. So Romans 7, that one's before Romans 8, 21 through 25. And I also put Philippians 2:13 there. And another one of her behaviors in the putting off category. She stayed up late watching TV. She went to sleep on the sofa every night. And then she would be too tired to attend church or whatever was coming that day. She would have to go to work, but she was too tired on her days or her times when she wasn't working. She was too tired to work on her house. And so I put Romans 8, 5 through 8. So, there we go. Verses, grace to overcome. I don't think I put Colossians 3:13 on there, but I added that on your sheets. And then a little bit of personal reflection, and at the very end, I have resources. So, we have only a couple of minutes before we definitely have to have a break. So, is there a question? Yes. Guarding my heart, when I talk to counselees about it, would be keeping those desires that are not part of God's plan, okay, out of my thinking and desiring. So I'm keeping my heart. That's another translation. Keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the wellsprings. I love that word, wellsprings of life. So, you know, I can certainly see where in relationships, in romantic type situations, you know, guard your heart about the, okay, but that's how I use it typically.
So keeping the
keeping your thoughts pure from those desires that would keep you, because see, the heart and the mind are basically the same thing, right? Okay. And so I could dwell on my desires that won't necessarily be those that please the Lord. In fact, I think I said something about that in here. So I want to keep it in the Word. I want to transform my thinking so that it affects everything. It affects my desire.
Thank you. That helps.
Does that help? Okay. Yes.
I'm just going to share a personal example. I think that this has been encouraging to me. I lost my job recently, or I resigned and kind of asked to resign because of some spiritual persecution. And so I've just been reminded, as I've studied God's Word, like, you know, I had a great relationship with my students and their parents, and they're going to ask questions, like, why aren't you coming back? And, you know, I need to be careful to guard my principal's reputation. You know, even though I feel like I was unjustly, you know,
sure,
to let that vengeance be mine, you know. And
yes, okay. I've been given the word.
I just don't want to cut it. Sorry.
Thank you.